An explosion over the weekend near Moscow kills the daughter of a high-profile ally of Russian President Vladimir Putin.
Russia's state news agency quoted an acquaintance of Dugina as saying the vehicle belonged to her father, who was probably the intended target.
So who is Alexander Dugin, who some have called Putin's brain?
He basically has a very far-right, ultra-nationalist position on Russia and its role in the world.
And later in the program, what the U.S. hopes its latest tranche of military aid will achieve for Kyiv. Today is Monday, August 22nd. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Miller. Russian officials confirmed that the daughter of an ultra-nationalist Russian ideologue who advocates Russia absorbing Ukraine was killed in a suspected car bomb attack on Saturday outside of Moscow. Reuters' Rachel Graham has the details.
Daria Dugina, who was killed on Saturday evening, was the daughter of prominent ideologue Alexander Dugin, who advocates Russia absorbing Ukraine and has been placed on a U.S. sanctions list. Described by investigators as a journalist and political expert, Dugina publicly backed her father's position and expressed support for Russia's intervention in Ukraine on state TV. The Russian Foreign Ministry speculated that Ukraine might have been behind the attack, though Ukraine denied any involvement. Russia's state news agency quoted an acquaintance of Dugina as saying the vehicle belonged to her father, who was probably the intended target. Father and daughter attended a festival outside Moscow, and Dugin decided to switch cars at the last minute, a Russian state newspaper reported. Some Russia watchers say Dugin holds significant sway over Russian President Vladimir Putin, but others dispute that.
Rachel Graham of Reuters News. Some media outlets have also described Alexander Dugin as Putin's brain, but who is this man that others have also described as a spiritual guide? That's the question that I put to Jennifer Mathers, senior lecturer at the Department of International Politics at Aberystwyth University in Wales.
So Alexander Dugin is a very interesting, sort of colorful character. He has been writing about Russia's place in the world since the early 1990s. And he basically has a very far-right, ultra-nationalist position on Russia and its role in the world. So he sees Russia's future as being not just, you know, a great power and acting in the world, but actually as the power that should dominate the Eurasian landmass. In other words, American influence, for example, should be excluded from that part of the world. And it should be Russia that really is the dominant power that decides what happens. And this is basically covering the whole of Eurasia. He has sort of limited influence, I would argue, actually over policymakers. He is an extraordinarily good self-publicist. So he's very good at promoting himself and speaking very loudly and forcefully and getting himself onto, you know, television and radio and quoted in the newspapers in Russia and so on. And so, you know, that really sort of gives an exaggerated impression of his influence and his ability. So I think it's probably not true to say that he's Putin's brain or he's Putin's guru or something of that nature. There's no evidence that he and Putin have ever met. And there's no evidence that Putin has ever read any of his work. But as Putin's sort of worldview has become much closer to Dugin's, I think this has allowed people to say, oh, well, Dugin must be the sort of the ideological power behind the throne of Putin. But I think that's it probably has more to do with a correlation rather than a causal mechanism.
Does Dugin have any kind of influence over, say, the general population as to how they view the rest of the world?
Well, he's not a terribly influential figure in Russia. He's done a much better job of making his connections with far-right movements in Europe and some also in the United States. And so in many respects, he is better known, his ideas are maybe better known outside of Russia than they are inside Russia. So I would say he's marginal. He has some impact. And certainly with the war in Ukraine, there's been a lot more willingness of Russian media outlets to give airtime and give attention to him and to others like him who promote the kinds of views which are more or less in tune with what the Kremlin is actually doing.
And one last question. Russian authorities have accused agents acting on behalf of Ukraine of carrying out this car bombing attack. Ukraine has denied any kind of responsibility with it. So my question to you is this. What kind of impact do you see this attack having in Russia?
I would actually not see Dugin's daughter's death as being a huge watershed in the way that politics in Russia is moving. It's likely to be an opportunity for the security services to embark on an even stricter crackdown, for even more hysterical rhetoric to come out. I mean, I've just seen that the FSB has named a suspect and claims that it has identified a Ukrainian member of the security services, the woman who allegedly went to Moscow with her daughter, conducted this assassination and then left again, conveniently leaving behind incriminating documents for the FSB to find. So they have a story, which they're now presenting. And whether that story is true or not, and I suspect it probably isn't, it will enable the security services to justify even more intrusive sort of crackdowns on any kind of opposition or anybody who might be suspected as harboring sort of pro-Ukrainian sympathies or, being against the Kremlin in some way or other. It will justify an uptick in the rhetoric, which is, not necessarily Putin's rhetoric, but the rhetoric of others around him and in the media and so on. But I don't really see it as marking any kind of a turning point in terms of public opinion or in terms of how the war is fought, because I think already Russia has been using some very extreme measures in the war. You know, we've had all kinds of very well evidenced claims of human rights abuses and war crimes and torture and murder and so on. So already the Kremlin is using really very extreme measures. I don't actually think they need much of a push from an event like this to justify doing a great deal more.
Jennifer Mathers is a senior lecturer in the Department of International Politics at Aberystwyth University in Wales. Dr. Mathers, thank you very much for your time. Ukraine reported fresh Russian aerial attacks on Monday near the site of a major nuclear power plant. This comes as Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky warned of potential Russian actions as the country prepares to mark the anniversary of its independence on the 24th. Russia and Ukraine have also traded blame for repeated shelling near the power plant. Ukraine has also asked the United Nations and other international organizations to force Russia to leave the site, which it has occupied since March, even as Ukrainian technicians operate the facility. Elsewhere, Russian forces are slowly advancing from the recently captured Luhansk region to Bakhmut in the Donetsk region. Joining us from Kyiv is reporter Anna Chernikova.
We can see that the situation is quite tough, especially in the Donbas and in the south. And of course, both sides have successes in different areas. If we talk about Ukrainian forces, the main action is happening in the south and in particularly in Kherson region. Today, just a couple of hours ago, the armed forces of Ukraine officially confirmed a new attack on the Antonovsky Bridge in Kherson. As we already know, this bridge is one of the main arteries for the Russian forces, for the logistics of the Russian forces. Today, the spokesperson, the armed forces of Ukraine in the south, said that the attack on this bridge, which is one of the transport routes that the Russians are trying to put back to operation because it was already heavily damaged before. So this attack is to show that Ukrainian forces have the full control of this breach and of this area.
And we'll have ongoing coverage of the big news events throughout the day on our website, voanews.com/flashpoint. But I wanted to ask you about something that took place over the weekend and how people are reacting in Kyiv to seeing these damaged and destroyed Russian material, the tanks and other artillery and other vehicles on the streets coming just days before Independence Day on Wednesday, the 24th.
Currently, the central street of the capital of Kyiv, Khreshchatyk Street, is actually a place for so-called illustration exposition of the destroyed Russian military equipment. This is to mark Ukrainian Independence Day, and during the weekend, hundreds of Kyiv citizens and guests of the capital, and probably some people who are internally displaced and stay in Kyiv for the moment, they visited this exposition. A lot of children, a lot of elder people, and really a huge amount of people were there. The most important, I guess, is that, and basically this is the main message also from the government, that this is basically how any kind of Russian equipment would look at the central of Ukraine, so in the capital. Because if we come back to the February 24th, and when Russian Federation was sure that Ukraine would fall in a couple of days, and that the parade of the Russian equipment would be happening at the Khreshchatyk Street by May 9th. Well, this is basically the message, which kind of parade could happen with Russian equipment.
Reporting from Kyiv, Ukraine, Anna Chernikova. Anna, thanks.
Thank you, Steve.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. Turkey is touting its recent success in brokering a deal to free up grain trapped in Ukrainian ports as a good reason why it should maintain close ties with Russia. Those relations are deepening further as Russian President Vladimir Putin invited Turkish leader Recep Tayyip Erdogan to attend a Russia-China Security Alliance meeting next month. Dorian Jones has that story.
Two more ships departed Ukraine for Greece and Egypt Monday, carrying 30,000 metric tons of grain. Since July's Turkey-UN brokered deal with Russia and Ukraine, more than 600,000 metric tons of grain have been exported from Ukrainian ports. On Saturday, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, accompanied by Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, visited the coordination center that's been set up in Istanbul. Speaking at a press conference, Guterres reaffirmed the importance of the grain deal.
Getting more food and fertilizer out of Ukraine and Russia is critical to further calm commodity markets and lower prices for consumers.
Guterres says Ankara played a pivotal role in securing the grain export deal. With increasing numbers of ships leaving Ukrainian ports, Ankara portrays the agreement as a vindication of its policy of maintaining close ties with Moscow. Political analyst Ilham Uzgel of the Duvar news portal.
Erdogan grabbed a role, diplomatic, showing to the West that Turkey can be a useful actor in this region and mitigating the adverse effects of the food crisis globally. So he's playing it domestically and internationally like he did before in many instances.
In the past month, Erdogan has met with Putin twice despite Western allies' efforts to ostracize the Russian leader. Ankara also refuses to enforce Western sanctions against Russia. In a move analysts say is likely to sow further discord with Turkey's NATO partners, Putin invited Erdogan to attend September's meeting of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, a Chinese Eurasian security organization. Galip Dalai, a Russia-Turkey expert at the London-based Chatham House, says Putin's invitation and regular meetings with Erdogan are part of a broader Russian strategy.
Putin telling to the international community, actually, I'm not as isolated as the West wants or portrays it to be. So the symbolism of these meetings, and including Erdogan's potential joining the Shanghai Cooperation meetings in Uzbekistan, the symbolism is more important than the substance. And I think right now, Putin's audience, the part of the West that is more skeptical of a heavy-handed policy towards Russia.
Erdogan argues that maintaining close ties with Putin, while at the same time having similar close relations with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, with whom he held talks last week in Ukraine, puts him in a unique position to end the conflict. Andris Uzgel says the brokering of the grain deal underscores that Erdogan could play such a role, but only when the sides are ready to talk.
If Putin decides to end the war, I don't know if Ukrainians will concede to the presence of Russian military there. At that point, Erdogan may play a role. He has a chance. He's a good candidate to bring these two sides together.
Criticisms of Erdogan over his ties to Putin from his Western allies have so far been muted. However, analysts say that silence will likely depend on whether Erdogan's close ties to Putin can continue to deliver tangible results in at least mitigating the worst effects of the Ukrainian war. Dorian Jones for VOA News, Istanbul.
On Friday, the United States announced it was preparing another $775 million security package for Ukraine, and this brings the total amount of aid pledged since Russia's invasion of Ukraine in February to $10.6 billion. VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden shared the details with me.
Well, the latest aid package that was announced by the Pentagon on Friday, the 19th such aid package since the start of the war in Ukraine, when Russian forces first went in this past February, includes more ammunition and more precision ammunition for the HIMAR systems. The U.S. has given Ukraine 16 of these high-mobility artillery rocket systems that the U.S. has been very effective for Ukraine in terms of striking key Russian supply lines, weapons depots, command and control centers that are behind enemy lines. These are systems that have a range of about 70 kilometers. The latest tranche of assistance is also going to include 15 Scan Eagle drones. These are drones that are used for reconnaissance, which will make the HIMARS and other artillery systems that have been given to Ukraine by the U.S. and others more effective. It includes 16 howitzers, 36,000 rounds for these howitzers, and also HARM, high-speed anti-radiation missiles that are U.S.-made missiles that can be attached now to the Ukrainian fighter planes and used to take out Russian radar systems that are helping the Russians as they try to advance in Ukraine. And that's not all. There's also more anti-armor capabilities. They have TOW missiles, which are 1,000 of them, known for their effectiveness against tanks and other armored vehicles. Also, 1,000 Javelin missiles, another round of Javelin missiles that have been used for that, anti-armor rifle rounds, and also mine Humvees, about 50 Humvees in this package to help move around troops, and mine-clearing equipment and systems, including MRAPs, vehicles that are armored and designed to be able to roll through, help protect soldiers from mines that have been laid in the ground, and also help with the clearing of some of those mines. So it's a pretty substantial package. It comes just about 3 weeks after the last package that the Pentagon announced, a $1 billion package, which also provided some of these capabilities and others.
Do they give any indication about how often they are going to be assessing the needs of Ukraine and potentially providing more aid? As you mentioned, it's only 3 weeks after the last announcement, and the United States has given over $10 billion in aid so far.
Senior U.S. officials, including a senior defense official who briefed reporters on the latest package, have indicated that this is just part of a process that is going to continue to go on. One senior defense official said point blank, quote, "This is not the end," in that the U.S. intends and its partners and Western allies intend to continue to speak with the Ukrainians and try as best they can to provide the Ukrainians with what support they need at the time that they need it. That doesn't mean that there isn't some friction between the Ukraine and the U.S. and other Western countries. Ukrainian officials have time and again asked for more fighter jets, modern fighter jets, something the U.S. says that it's looking at, but for the long term, not the short term. The Ukrainians have also asked for tanks. There have been some movement in that area, but not from the U.S. And also the Ukrainians have been asking for longer range missile systems. They want a system known as a TACMS, missiles that are precise and can hit targets 300 kilometers away, which would give the Ukrainians much greater range in terms of trying to take out Russian targets. The U.S. has said that the Ukrainians are doing very well with what they have right now and has not agreed to provide those types of systems. One of the things that the U.S. has said in Ukraine so far says it's willing to do is to not use U.S. systems to hit Russian targets inside of Russia proper. And for now, though, the U.S. is saying that they're not going to give those longer range systems.
So, Jeff, I guess the question I have for you is this. According to the United States, what is the hope that this aid package will allow the Ukrainian military to do?
Well, it does a number of things. And the Pentagon has, you know, one senior defense official kind of alluded to the possibility of a Ukrainian counteroffensive, especially in the south. While the Russians have not been able to make many gains, the U.S. says, from what it's seeing, that the Russians are paying a high cost for any gains they try to make, and that their forces are being hollowed out, that they're more vulnerable and really not able to make any more drives into Ukraine. That being said, the Ukrainian armed forces haven't been able to retake any significant territory in Ukraine that was taken by Russian forces in the early stages of this invasion. So what these systems that are being provided in this latest tranche of security assistance can do, provide the Ukrainian military perhaps with some more mobility, more capability to start launching that type of offensive, especially in the south, where there are mines that are blocking them right now, and where they'll need to move and protect troops in order to retake territory. These systems that they're getting in this latest package could help in that end, and it may enable the Ukrainians to finally launch the counteroffensive that's been hinted at now for so long.
VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden. Jeff, thank you very much for your time.
Anytime.
Afghanistan's Taliban say that they are in talks with Russia to import 1 million metric tons of petroleum products, possibly in exchange for raisins, raw materials for medicines, and minerals. A Taliban delegation was in Moscow Friday holding meetings with Russian officials and private businesses to boost mutual trade ties and encourage investment in the war-torn South Asian nation. For the details, I spoke with VOA's Ayaz Gul in Islamabad.
It's a high-level Taliban commerce ministry and industry ministry delegation and experts from finance ministry are in this team that has gone to Moscow to negotiate a deal as quickly as possible because they desperately need oil. I mean, obviously gasoline and diesel in Afghanistan. As you know, with the international forces out of the country now, that is one of the commodities, you know, that Taliban really need to arrange for the population so that the business can go on.
What is known, if anything, about how this kind of transaction, whether it be either by payment or by bartering, would that, you know, hamper any kind of aid that the Taliban has been requesting since it took power a year ago?
Well, what we understand from what the minister said today was that the United States and the European Union, they both have no objection to these kind of understandings or trade understandings that the Taliban or the Afghan authorities reach with any country, because we know that Afghanistan is facing a serious humanitarian crisis already, and now with these international sanctions on the Taliban regime, economy is on the verge of collapse. So under these circumstances, even the United Nations has repeatedly warned that international community needs to do a lot to make sure that ordinary Afghans do not suffer, as out of 40 million people in that country, 98% will be suffering some kind of food shortages by the end of this year. So I think this is the seriousness of the situation, which has encouraged the Taliban delegates to reach out to countries like Russia and China.
VOA's Ayaz Gul. That's going to do it for us today. You'll find even more coverage of news and world events on our social media platforms. Just be sure to follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire team at Flashpoint Ukraine, thank you very much for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Miller. Be well, be safe, and good night.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.